From KCUR News, this is Casey Currents, reporting news and culture in Kansas City's diverse communities and beyond. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. This week, we look back at some of the biggest stories of the year.
I was just like, I thought I was dead at first.
And some of our favorites.
And I started to set my glass down, and from the middle of the table, a voice came that said, "Get your glass off my dress, I've got to perform."
We'll hear about the year in agriculture and a profile of a musical group that the Kansas City Star just named the local band of the year.
We were not supposed to play that,
no.
But we did, and it gave us a really good head start.
It's Casey Currents. Listen up just after this news. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. Welcome to Casey Currents. We use stories and sound to take you to neighborhoods around the region. Harmony in City Hall and winning sports teams. Are we still in Kansas City? Each year, our afternoon newsman Steve Bell looks back at the year's top local stories and picks out what he sees as the most important. You'll hear his year in review segment on Saturday morning and find it online at kcur.org. But he agreed to sit down with us here on Casey Currents and share a preview. Thanks for joining us, Steve.
You're quite welcome. And it's a preview, yes, but I must warn you that the program is not done yet as we record this. So this is a preview of an unfinished program.
And we never know what will happen before the end of the week, right?
No, that's true. And stories can change and their importance can change.
Every year you have your unexpected disasters, sadly, and this year it was on the plaza.
Mm-hmm. The JJ's fire and explosion, which occurred back early this year, is a uniquely Kansas City story. It's certainly not a story that affected the most people directly, but let's think about this. It is a favorite Kansas City landmark, sort of our trademark, the Country Club Plaza. It's an established and popular place. A number of people were seriously injured, burned, and one person died. Plus the fact that we have accusations against a number of people, utilities, companies, and lawsuits still pending that we don't know how they're going to come out.
We still don't know exactly who to blame for the explosion that happened there.
Not precisely. I don't think that we'll ever know exactly who was to blame. One of the OSHA reports cited the restaurant owner as partly, a very small part, to blame for not creating a good disaster plan. I think most people would look at that and say, well, maybe you should have one, but who thinks that's going to happen? Mm. Certainly the utility companies and their contractors and their inability to find and report where the gas lines were and what the problems might be or how serious the problems were certainly looms as a major thing in these lawsuits.
Now, you follow City Hall quite closely, Steve, and a number of important stories this year came out of City Hall. First of all, Harmony?
Harmony is a kind of a non-story, but it is a huge story, and it hasn't gotten much airtime or ink. We got to look back to the previous administration at City Hall and the previous council, which gets a lot of mention in chambers and in meetings for its conflict. And sometimes that conflict was vicious in terms of it was cutthroat. And in this council, we've had no harsh clashes, some tough debate, yes, including on council districts, but none of the kinds of things that were going on. As a matter of fact, Mayor James a few weeks ago made a comment that this is unusual for this council to have a debate this heated. And the projects have moved along at City Hall with, generally speaking, pretty good unanimity. And the thing that called my attention to this is that we have a brand new satisfaction study, a city satisfaction study, and the hallmark of previous satisfaction studies during the previous administration was dissatisfaction with leadership in the city, which was as high as 58% of the Kansas City residents said they were dissatisfied with leadership at City Hall. Now it's down to 17%.
That's a big change, isn't
it? Huge change.
And as far as some of the big city projects, how far did the streetcar plan get this year?
Well, this is very encouraging for streetcar fans. After years of plans and accepted and rejected and attempted and voted down, that we actually have rails in the ground, in the street, downtown, on the bridge leading up to Main Street. We haven't had any rails before. We got $20 million from the federal government. We have a financing plan that we believe is sound and will hold up, although there are still some lawsuits pending against that. And the city council has gone so far as to start laying the planning for Phase 2, the first expansion, and even defined where the route or routes are probably going to be.
Now, tell me, what happened to red light cameras this year?
The future looks rather grim for red light cameras, which have been a favorite of the police department and the city council, both of which insist that they have dramatically improved safety at the intersections where they are installed. From the start, there has been a contingent that says it's about revenue, it's about socking it to the public, and that it's unconstitutional. And right now, that's the side that's winning. We've got three court decisions from an appellate court that are, in one way or another, against the red light cameras. And although the state Supreme Court has been approached about resolving the conflict, we have no idea whether the state Supreme Court will take the case or not.
And what about this contentious plan to overhaul the airport?
The plan to overhaul the airport has slowed down a lot, partly because of citizen resistance, partly because Southwest Airlines brought up an issue about their participation, although they now say that they are being included. At first, they said they weren't being included enough. And the immense cost of $1.2 billion, which a lot of people have a hard time believing can be spent without the city getting involved, if only in backing bonds for its construction, to the tune of being unable to meet some of the infrastructure demands and basic services demands that these people want the city to take care of.
Now, speaking of harmony, there also appeared to be peace and some academic improvement in Kansas City public schools. But this year, the turmoil came from outside the district.
Oh, a tremendously frustrating year for Kansas City School District. There is something to be said for the critics. It has been a short-term, one-time improvement. Academic scores have not increased that much. But for the first time in years, we have a superintendent who seems to not only know what he's doing, but have support of the board and have good ideas. We have a board that is unified and not fighting among themselves. We have some gains on the test scores. And then the big frustration comes. The district was hoping to get provisional accreditation based on its scores on the various things and didn't get it, and was told that it may be another 2 years before you do. And by the way, a Supreme Court decision says that during those 2 years, kids can transfer out to neighboring districts, and the district they're transferring out of has to pay the costs. And that potentially affects, to some degree, every school district on the Missouri side of the state line.
And so we'll see, I think in January, a report from this organization that we're contracted to about what the state's plans are for the Kansas City public schools.
And that has generated a tremendous controversy also. There's been some things, Associated Press and some news media filed an open records request for some emails, and they questioned maybe whether the proper bidding process had been undertaken in the letting of that contract, and maybe whether the education commissioner went into it with a predetermined agenda. And there's even been calls for the resignation or firing of the education commissioner.
Steve Bell is the afternoon newscaster here at KCUR. Steve, what about on the economic development front? What was new in 2013?
Maybe the biggest thing on the economic development front has been that the Kansas City, Missouri City Council has been unified on its ideas about development, been able to reach decisions without major strife. The other thing has been that the border wars have continued with companies trying and successfully poaching ferns from across the Kansas side of the state line to the Missouri, which a lot of people point out often doesn't create any new jobs and just shifts where the tax money is going. And by the way, to get them to move, the state they're moving to gives up a ton of tax money and ends up costing their facilities and their schools and their libraries and their basic services. And now there have been some things that have promised real jobs or preserved real jobs. Expansion by Ford and General Motors. General Motors put $600 million into their plant here. That means that those 3,700 jobs are going to be secure, and maybe there will be more. Ford put on another shift of 900 workers at their plant. The Sprint SoftBank thing, it was a big story, I think, locally because of the huge amount of money involved. We're talking about nearly $23 billion. And also the fact that Sprint has been, quote, the hometown phone company. But also the fact that that merger gave the company new power and new ability to finance its ventures means some degree of security about keeping that headquarters here and keeping those jobs here. And then finally, Neil Patterson's suggestion and plan that he's trying to activate to rebuild the area around the old Bannister Mall. We are talking about the possibility of one of the largest office complexes ever being built anywhere. And they're saying up front as many as 15,000 new jobs.
Hmm. And what about the tax cuts that went into effect in Kansas this year?
Governor Brownback got his way, finally. The Kansas legislature had a hard time arriving at a budget, and they had a hard time deciding on the governor's tax package. But let's face it, Kansas has an overwhelming Republican majority in both houses of the legislature and a Republican governor, and there was strong influence from the extremely conservative wing of the Republican Party. As a matter of fact, the moderates are kind of out in the cold right now. So the governor got his tax cuts, and then other states around it said, we've got to do that too. And in Missouri, we had a Democratic governor who vetoed a similar tax cut plan to kind of basically eventually do away with income tax and replace it with a sales tax. And the Republicans in Missouri were not able to get enough votes to override the veto. Now, how's it all coming out? It's hard to say. The latest figures show that Kansas has added somewhere between 2,000 and 3,000 new jobs since the tax cuts began. Missouri, to begin with, has twice as many people working at jobs, but they've added 10 times as many jobs as Kansas has added. What does that mean? It remains to be seen.
Well, I saved sports for the kicker here, but what happened in KC this year?
Probably the biggest stories of the year. I mean, is that good after years when the top stories were disasters and weather emergencies and tornadoes and shortfalls and budget cuts and Lord knows what, that this year two of the biggest stories come out of sports and they're happy stories? That for the first time in years, the Kansas City Chiefs pretty well got their act together. Now, they had a 9-game winning streak, and then they've had some stumbles since then with a young team, but they're still assured a playoff berth as a wild card playoff berth. And I can't recall the last time that has happened. I have a Chiefs shirt that I wear sometime, and I say the last time I wore this shirt, the quarterback's name was Joe Montana. And that tells you how long. And then soccer sort of came into its own in Kansas City. We've been able to consistently pretty much fill the park, and we've been able to produce a team that won the Major League Soccer Championship, actually a real championship trophy in Kansas City, not just a playoff. Boy, is that good news for sports fans.
Steve Bell is our afternoon news reporter here at KCUR. Tune in this Saturday morning for the Year in Review. Thank you so much for joining us, Steve.
It's always a pleasure. It's always fun.
One local story really caught the nation's attention this year. You might have first heard about it on our airwaves back in July. It was about a rape case that occurred just north of Kansas City in Maryville, Missouri. The details of the story are all too familiar. High school football players, alcohol, and cell phone videos. But unlike a very similar case in Steubenville, Ohio last year, this case seemed to disappear as quickly as it erupted, leaving the town talking, law enforcement under question, and two girls dealing with very grown-up problems. Earlier this year, KCUR's Monica Sandretsky and Peggy Lowe spent some time with one of the young women who survived the alleged assault. We're going to hear an excerpt from Monica's story today. A warning to our listeners, the story you're about to hear contains some explicit content and profane language.
The first thing Daisy remembers from that night is her surprise she was still alive.
I was just like, I thought I was dead at first. I was really confused. I was like, what is happening? Like, I couldn't even make sense of anything.
January 8th, 2012. It was 5 a.m. Daisy was lying on the front yard of her family's home in Maryville. The then 14-year-old had been outside about 3 hours, unconscious in freezing temperatures. She wasn't wearing shoes or a jacket, just a t-shirt and sweatpants. Her hair was wet and frozen. She couldn't speak and was barely able to crawl. Her mom, Melinda, and younger brother, Tristan, found her after she dragged herself, crying, to the front door. They were almost as confused as Daisy was.
It almost sounded like somebody just falling against the door. I kept thinking, did she sleepwalk?
Yeah.
Or, you know, and she had absolutely no idea.
Melinda's first worry was that Daisy's feet were frostbitten, so she began to put her daughter in a cool bath, hoping to warm her up slowly. As she removed Daisy's pants, Melinda Coleman found bruises and red marks.
And I asked her if she hurt, and she said yes.
Did you see bruises and stuff? Like,
Yeah. And really, really red marks and stuff.
That's when Melinda called 911. After talking with law enforcement, they left for the hospital. The story came out in bits and pieces over the next few hours. The night before, Daisy and a 13-year-old friend she thought of as her little sister had a sleepover at the Coleman's house.
I can't exactly remember most of the night, so it's not going to be much of a story. But what I do remember is me and my friend were drinking in my bedroom without my mom's permission. And then this guy texted me and he's like, hey, you want to hang out? And I was like, well, I'll have to sneak around. It's like 1 a.m.
The guy who texted with Daisy was Matthew Barnett, a 17-year-old who was friends with Daisy's older brother, Charlie. Daisy's mom said she knew Barnett pretty well, along with 3 other boys we'll mention later.
4 of the boys that were involved were, we thought, Charlie's friends. They played football with him and wrestled with him, and they'd been at our house watching the playoffs. In fact, I'd made chili for him a few nights before.
Charlie says these guys called themselves the Wolf Pack, a reference to the movie The Hangover 2.
It was before school even started when the Wolf Pack thing happened my senior year. Like, it was just a group of them that were friends, and I think The Hangover 2 came out that summer, and they were just obsessed with the movie, so they all made shirts, tie-dye shirts, or had them made with their names on the back, and I think it just went from there.
Melinda says Charlie had told Daisy to keep away from Barnett. But that night in January, Matthew Barnett drove over to the Colemans after their texting conversation and picked up Daisy and her friend, along with another young guy who was underage. They snuck into Barnett's parents' home through a basement window, joining the other 3 guys from the Wolf Pack, and Daisy continued drinking, using a glass that has since become infamous.
Excuse my language. But they called it the Bitch Cup, and it's a really, really tall shot glass. I think it had, like, lines, like, if you drank that much, you were, like, some rank or whatever. Like, I don't know, you're, like, a B-word if you only take, like, half of it or something.
The rest of the story from that night is told in Nottoway County Sheriff's reports. As Daisy continued drinking, her friend and the underage boy went into one of the bedrooms. Burnett admitted to having sex with Daisy in another room, but said she wasn't drunk yet, just buzzed, as he put it. Another boy, 17-year-old Jordan Zeck, told investigators that he used a buddy's iPhone to video Barnett and Daisy kissing, half undressed. Barnett, Zeck, and 2 other boys said they all watched the video, then deleted it. The younger girl and the boys later told sheriff's investigators that Daisy was incoherent and had to be carried back out the window of the Barnett's basement. And Melinda says that start to finish, the event didn't take long.
We found out later from the text messaging and from the phone calls, they picked the girls up just a few minutes before 1, and they dropped him off by 2. So they were pretty efficient. They knew what they were doing.
The boys drove the girls back to the Colemans, throwing a condom out the window along the way. The boys told the younger girl to go inside, and they propped Daisy up against the house as she was vomiting and deposited her purse, shoes, and a cell phone. It was 3 hours before Daisy's mom and younger brother found her and took her to the hospital. The hospital ran a rape kit on Daisy that morning, but the Colemans say they've never seen the results. By that afternoon, Sheriff Darren White says Barnett admitted to having consensual sex with Daisy, and Zek confessed to the cell phone taping.
I was pretty happy with it because we had what I considered to be a very serious crime, and within a matter of a few hours, we had warrants for their arrest, and they had been arrested. That's a pretty good day.
The underage boy with Daisy's friend admitted to rape and was charged and later convicted in the juvenile system. But in Missouri, 17-year-olds are considered to be adults in the criminal justice system. So Barnett was charged with a felony for sexual assault and a misdemeanor for child endangerment.
That was an excerpt from a report by KCUR's Monica Sandretsky and Peggy Lowe about a rape case that split the town of Maryville in two after charges against a football player were suddenly dropped. The sheriff said a crime clearly occurred, but the Nottoway County prosecutor said he didn't have enough evidence to pursue a criminal case. Meanwhile, the Colemans moved away from Maryville. They said they were driven out of town by bullying and attacks on social media. When the whole story went viral in October, national social media attacks were directed at the town of Maryville. The Hackers Collective Anonymous did all it could to draw attention to the case. The courts ended up naming a special prosecutor, Jackson County's Jean Peters Baker. She's reinvestigating the case and expected to make an announcement about it in the next month. This past summer on Casey Currents, we ran a series of stories inspired by the work of iconic Mexican artists Frida Kahlo and Diego Rivera. They were part of an exhibit this summer at the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art. Kahlo and Rivera had a famously tempestuous relationship, which often inspired their art. So we decided to profile eight Kansas City couples for whom art is a part of their relationship. We'll listen to one of those stories now by KCUR intern Claire McInerney.
Ron McGee in John Fulton Adams' house reminds me of the set of an old horror movie. Chestnut 1884, as they call her, is an old Victorian-style home in the historic Northeast. The house is a strong reflection to their styles as artists. Ron McGee is an actor, director, playwright, and staple in the Kansas City theater scene. His husband, John Fulton Adams, is a costume and clothing designer. The two are giving me a tour of some of their favorite things around their house.
This is our cabinet of curiosities. And what you fill it with is bones and bottles and different things that make us happy.
There's taxidermy in every room. Most of the time, the animals are wearing a hat or a scarf. And, as any good host, Ron keeps offering me something to drink.
Do you guys want a swig of moonshine from Kentucky?
John describes the vibe of the house perfectly and why they decorate it the way they do.
I'm so used to being in and around theaters that I feel the need to live, in a way, on a set.
And for two people who thrive on the dramatic, both say they were shocked when they found themselves wanting to settle down with each other. After they got married 6 years ago, a ceremony not recognized by the state but significant to their relationship, the two moved into a house and are now raising two dogs and three chickens together.
Ladies, let's get you some food. You want to come inside?
John said he didn't believe in soulmates until he met Ron, and neither imagined they'd crave watching Stephen King and Bruce Willis movies at night. But the two weren't always so comfortable with each other. In fact, Ron's first impression of John was really negative.
I thought he was stuck up and mean.
John didn't feel the same way, though. He was intrigued by Ron after their unique meeting at a benefit.
And I started to set my glass down, and from the middle of the table, a voice came that said, "Get your glass off my dress. I've got to perform. I'm going on." And I looked up, and the centerpiece was Ron McGee, and he was dressed as a table.
But since you can't judge a book by its cover, or a table by its centerpiece, the two ended up dating. But for two intensely creative people, dating someone else with similar passion can backfire. John dated many other artists and describes the negative effect these relationships had on both his personal life and his work.
A lot of people I've dated have not understood my creative drive. It's gone from not supporting to completely trying to squelch it.
Ron also struggled when dating other actors, but describes him and John's working relationship to be as cohesive and complementary as the romantic one.
One great thing is his design world is backstage and mine's on stage. So we can mesh together easier.
This ability to learn from one another has intertwined their professional and personal lives. Both Ron and John agree that once they met each other, their respective art careers were influenced by the other. Ron will incorporate inside jokes, like the couple's love of Red Lobster, into a play he's writing. And John has costumed many of Ron's shows, using design he knows that they both will love. And now that they are settled into their marriage, Ron and John praise the Kansas City art community for helping them with this life they've created together. Both have lived in different places and agree that Kansas City is the best place to practice their art. After living in expensive cities, Ron enjoys how cheap it is to live here, because he can focus on his acting career and not stress about money. John has a different connection with the city and its art community, which stems from a rocky relationship with his family a few years ago. When Ron and John got married, nobody from John's side of the family attended.
That community is our, I'll say our, it's our chosen family. If you look at our wedding pictures, we had jazz players and burlesque dancers and dominatrixes and drag queens. But when I look at the picture, I just see brothers and sisters.
And in addition to their art family in Kansas City, both Ron and John can't imagine creating their art and sharing their passion without the other.
And in theater and in art world, at times I feel it's a very lonely world.
And why do you say that?
Because you're giving your all to people. It's a, when you step on stage, you should be giving 110%. And that's 350 people plus, or how many's in your audience, 50, whatever, is taking that energy from you. And if you don't have someone to give back to you, it can be very lonely. So I don't feel alone anymore. Also, we have two dogs and two chickens. And that helps, too.
John is currently working on a high-end couture line he hopes to launch in September, while still working at Churchill and teaching costuming at William Jewell. Ron just finished Lyle the Crocodile at the Coterie, where he starred as Mr. Grumps, who had a passionate love of his own for his beloved cat.
So love-lovey-dovely, so perfectly huggable, soft and snuggable, love-lovey-dovely, so gentle and cuddlish. I turn into
for Casey Currents, this is Claire McInerney.
Like peaches and cream, we two are a team, I feel so befuddlish.
See photos of Ron McGee and John Fulton Adams in their home and at work, and find all of the stories in this summer's Creative Couples series on our website, kcur.org. This is Casey Currents. This is Casey Currents. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. One of the areas we follow closely here at KCUR is agriculture. We all have some connection to it, whether we have roots in farm country, as a lot of Kansas Cityans do, or just find our food in the supermarket or at restaurants. So for a look at the top stories in agriculture this year, Peggy Lowe of Harvest Public Media joins us now. Thanks for stopping in.
Good morning.
Harvest has been around for 3 years now. How have the big stories kind of shifted from 2011 when you first launched?
This might be part of our own evolution here at Harvest Public Media, because I've written, I think, three what are the top ag stories of the years now. This is my third one this year. And the first year, we really focused on issues. It was more, you know, explanatory journalism, I think. And now we are moving more and more towards news stories and even becoming sort of the experts in this field that then explain what just happened in the news. So I think we've moved a bit from sort of overall concepts to actual events, news events.
It can be hard to understand the significance of some of these big business stories and what that means for what we actually eat.
Absolutely. I mean, food companies are enormous. They're corporate. They are on a global scale. So, for instance, a couple of things that happened this year that were really big. Smithfield Foods, the world's largest pork producer based in Virginia, was sold to the Chinese. And so, you know, what does that mean for American pork supply? What does that mean for overall international trade? You know, we looked at a lot of issues like that. That was actually one of the biggest stories of the year.
Were there other stories in big ag business?
The top four beef companies decided to quit buying cattle treated with a controversial growth promoter called Zilmax. And because of that, then the drug company that makes Zilmax had to take it off the market. And the reason why this was a big deal is because basically Zilmax is like a bodybuilder steroid type of thing that makes these cattle enormous. And it led to animal welfare issues. Temple Grandin even came in and said, hey, it's making the cattle lame and lethargic, and this, we just can't have this. So the company's backed off because of that reason. That said, the a lot of countries overseas ban Zilmax. They think it can hurt humans. And so then it becomes something, and another story too. You know, if U.S. beef producers are making this kind of beef for American consumers and they don't include that in beef for overseas, what's that mean for us? And is that safe? And will it continue to be like that in the future?
There are similar questions being asked about antibiotics this year, too.
Big time. Antibiotics were some of the most popular stories we did this year, whether that was antibiotic use in poultry, for instance, or otherwise. In poultry, antibiotics are used for the same reason Zilmax is used in cattle. It's to, you know, make them really big. And so they basically weigh more and the producers can get more profit. So the thing is, though, is that safe for humans? And even now, the government is coming in and saying the overuse of antibiotics in animal production, meat production, is really a concern. And they're going to try to, you know, make that a lesser problem in the next few years.
Has some of this been a result of consumer concern, or is it new science?
No, I think it's absolutely consumer concern. And more and more and more, that is driving the market, it's driving the industry, it's driving what we cover. More and more Americans want to know what's in their food. And so you even saw that entering the political arena in the last couple of years. In California and in Washington state, labeling laws have failed to pass in large measure because the food companies came in and just spent billions fighting those ballot proposals. So this is a really interesting trend, I think, in food production overall, is consumers wanting to know exactly what's part of their food supply.
So the labeling issue. Now, one of the labels that did pass is this labeling on meat, the cool labels.
Right. And this has been in the works for a while, but this was a good story that our reporter Abby Swanson did out of Columbia. And COOL stands for Country of Origin Labeling. So basically, not only will you know what's in your meat, but you're going to know where it comes from. So there's now labels on each packet of meat that says born, raised, and slaughtered. So it could have been born in Mexico, slaughtered there, and then, you know, processed in the U.S., that kind of thing. So now you will know at least what country your meat's coming from.
Now, one of your reporters also points to a kind of public relations showdown happening this year between two factions in the food industry. Can you explain that?
This is a fascinating part to me of what we've been covering now for the last 3 years. And it was pointed out by our newest reporter. His name is Luke Runyon, and he joined us at KUNC in Greeley, Colorado. They're the newest part of Harvest Public Media. He said what he was surprised in being sort of the new eyes and ears at Harvest was this big public relations war that sort of industrialized ag was fighting with that sector of the food production industry that wants more sustainable and organic production. And so it's become sort of this red state, blue state of politics. You know, he even covered a Millions Against Monsanto rally in Colorado and was very, very, you know, sort of surprised at the politicalization of food. So that's an ongoing story for us.
And we saw it play out in television advertisements from the beginning of the year last year, the Super Bowl. Right.
Absolutely. I mean, there was this ad that ran during the Super Bowl. It was actually an ad for Dodge Ram trucks. But really, the the countryside of the media really took to it because it was voiced by Paul Harvey, and it showed these
the old-time radio guy.
Right, and it showed this very romantic version of farm country, and it was also taken up by a lot of the industrialized ag sector. And we're going to play you a cut right now.
And on the eighth day, God looked down on his planned paradise and said, I need a caretaker. So God made a farmer. God said, I need somebody willing to get up before dawn, milk cows, work all day in the fields, milk cows again, eat supper, then go to town and stay past midnight at a meeting of the school board. So God made a farmer.
And then there was kind of a response to this ad.
Well, it wasn't exactly a response, but it's certainly an ongoing thing that Chipotle is doing. Now, Chipotle, of course, has been really at the forefront of creating fast food that is natural, sustainable, organic. Last year, they had a very popular ad online. This year's ad is called Scarecrow.
Come with me and you'll be in a world of pure imagination. Take a look and you'll see into your imagination.
It's an animated short, and it's basically an indictment of factory farming and factory food production and how, you know, there was like pictures of little animated chickens going into a factory and coming out in a box and that kind of thing. The song that it's set to is a Willy Wonka song, and it's sung by Fiona Apple, and it's a very kind of dark, even darkly shaded animation.
And I should just end up by mentioning the Farm Bill.
The Farm Bill. The Farm Bill, again, is on the top 10 list of what we covered this year. And I'm saying that sort of just like the Farm Bill because there's a lot of frustration around it. And we're kind of tired of covering it, I have to say, just to be perfectly honest, because it's been pending now for 2 years and Congress hasn't moved on it. And so we've gone through two expirations and they've had two little Band-Aid holdovers. And now they're promising to move on it next year, but we'll see whether or not Congress can actually get their act together and do that.
And essentially, what's the big holdup?
The big holdup is House Republicans. This year, it was SNAP money. That is food stamps. They believe that they should cut the food stamp program dramatically because the food stamp program, of course, is part of the Farm Bill. So that's been the biggest holdup so far.
Peggy Lowe is a reporter with Harvest Public Media, the agricultural reporting service based here at KCUR. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Earlier this year, Luis Balastegui attempted to complete a long, brutal motorcycle race in an unprecedented way. He's originally from Argentina and now lives in Kansas City. The Takar Rally snakes across thousands of miles of rugged South American mountains and desert. Each year, contestants die. Only about half the motorbike riders finish the two-week ordeal, generally thanks to good luck and careful planning. But Balastegui didn't have much of either. He did, however, have one distinct advantage up his sleeve, literally, something that profoundly altered the race and revealed the real reason he had entered it in the first place. KCUR's Frank Morris reports on Balastegui's adventures and misadventures racing in the Dakar Rally.
This wasn't the first time Luis Balastegui had entered the Dakar Rally. Last year, a bad crash late in the race broke his hand, tore up his knee, and knocked him out of the competition. This year, he barely made it through the first day. Last-minute mechanical modifications hobbled his motorcycle. Then after a frantic night of retooling, Luis jumped on his bike and roared off into the desert for the second stage, unaware that his front fender was now rubbing against his radiator hose.
It broke it, and I lost all the coolant. And when you're riding in the desert, you don't notice. The bike overheated and I blew the engine. Yeah, not very promising. Plus, I got stuck in the desert, 80 kilometers from the finish. Uh-huh. So I thought for a moment that the race was over for me.
So he's stranded under the blazing sun, alone, except for the occasional dune buggy tearing by, as you can see from this little flip cam video he made to document the event for his wife and three sons back in Kansas City.
Clavado. Sigue clavado el motor. Así que bueno, ahora... To my right, big sand dunes. In front of me, bigger sand dunes. Back, they were a couple of bushes, maybe 2 meters tall.
Another thing dwarfed by this vast desert, Luis's engine. He insists on racing a bike powered by one 2 or 3 times smaller than those used by his rivals. An ecologically minded motorsport fanatic, Luis is out to prove that an efficient 150cc bike is up for the race. And do it in style. He's sporting his signature huge salt and pepper mustache and a whole lot of pink.
I have pink wheels on my bike. I have the pink ribbon in my jacket. And I have it on decals on the bike.
All to remind people about breast cancer. He's also got one of those pink rubber bracelets, but we'll get to that. At the moment, it's not looking too good. It's 100 degrees plus, and Luis has to attempt major surgery on the bike by himself. And, oh yeah, he's traveling extremely light. He carries no spare parts other than a handful of zip ties and a little pocket toolkit. A pitifully small arsenal to take on the big job ahead.
It is one problem at the time. It keeps you going. Right. If you think of the big picture, you probably quit. So first the hose, then the water.
He used his drinking water to fill up the radiator.
Then the cylinder. And I thought it was done when I got the cylinder freed. I thought it was eventually going to start. But it didn't. It just didn't. At that point, I did not know what was going on. So the thing to do was to keep looking. So I take the cylinder head off, and I see that there's no head gasket. It had disintegrated with the heat.
Oh, great.
And that was my reaction. Oh, great. Because at that point, I hadn't even seen a head gasket of that bike.
Now, you may never have seen a head gasket, period. Not much to look at. They're basically seals between the top and bottom part of an engine that keep oil and coolant from leaking out or mixing. You have to work, though. Blow one in your car and you'll likely be out a good $1,000, mostly for labor. Of course, Luis, stranded, can't go to a mechanic or even a parts store. He must improvise.
And I start looking around my bike, my clothes, everything that I had to see if I could figure out what to use.
To make a head gasket out there in the desert with a tool kit the size of a sandwich.
Yes. I wasn't in a hurry then. It's not like, oh, I need to get going. It's like, I need to solve this problem. So how? And you just look around and think. And just looking around, I see in my wrist, my sister died of breast cancer. She fought breast cancer for 10 years. And she died about 4 or 5 years ago. And I used one of these pink bracelets. Because I look at the bracelet. It is made out of a silicone kind of material. It had about the right diameter. So I said, well, this is my head gasket. So it needed to be as smooth as I could. So I took my time and I cut it very nicely. And I put it on. And then I... continue.
You put the bike back together.
Uh-huh.
You get the bike started.
Yes.
And then, how's it running?
Really bad. Really, really bad.
So that meant Luis had to piece together an alternative route across the open desert to avoid the dunes, one that drove him far out of his way and ignited a whole new adventure. Suffice to say, he managed to sputter across that day's endpoint from the wrong direction in the dark. And so how'd the rest of the race go then?
As good as this stage. Yeah. I had problems with everything this race. I ended up blowing 4 engines. I broke the frame twice. And all sorts of things happened to the bike.
He even had to cut again into the scrap of pink bracelet he had left to fabricate yet another head gasket. He made it, though, in the end, 5,500 miles across some of the meanest terrain imaginable to cross the finish line.
What position did you finish in?
The very last one. And I thought it would bother me to finish last.
But it didn't. Because somewhere toward the end of his ordeal, Luis had a revelation about his late sister and his pink bracelet.
And I always felt that she was my model, that I could not do what she could. And to have found the solution to my problem in what was the symbol of her for me, it was like, I'm not alone. She's helping me some way. I don't believe in ghosts or in anything like that, but her experience and her symbol being able to help me continue fighting and showing me that I could find solutions, it was really strong for me.
Frank Morris, KCUR News.
We're going to end the show today with a profile of a band the Kansas City Star called the Band of the Year. These three young brothers from St. Joseph released their second EP to much critical acclaim this year. They toured Europe and were written up everywhere from the New York Times to Spin magazine. Casey Current's Matthew Long Middleton talked to the Radke brothers back in September and found that at that point, recognition at home had been harder to come by.
Check.
One, two,
check.
Hello, check.
When they came into the studio for our interview one night, I was surprised by how small the brothers were. Considering their deep vocals and charging sounds, I'd suspected they'd be bigger. They sat down to the mics, one dressed in a flannel button-down, the youngest in a Star Wars t-shirt, and the other in a torn, faded denim vest.
My name's Darian, and I play guitar and lead vocals in Radke.
My name is Isaiah Radke. I play the bass, and I lay down the background vocals.
I'm Solomon Yaki. I play drums.
They formed the band 3 years ago, when Saul was just 13, Isaiah 15, and Dee 17. Besides their age, the other remarkable thing about them as a punk band is how often they're together with their parents.
All the time. We have a better relationship with our parents and with each other than a lot of people have with their parents or, you know, their siblings. So whatever they did it right. I don't remember what they did, but yeah, whatever it was. I wasn't taking notes. I wish I was taking notes.
One of the things their parents did was share music. Their father, Matt Radke, had a library full of music, like Van Halen, the Pixies, the Ramones, and others. Another one of the things their parents did was homeschool the brothers. Isaiah and Dee remember the 1 year they actually spent in school.
I wanted out of there, though, because I wasn't into... I don't know, just the kids just didn't get me. They didn't get the music we dug, and they just didn't get it, so we just got out of there.
They get you all in trouble for no reason. For some reason, you get in trouble because of their stupid, you know, decisions.
Entire classrooms getting in trouble for one kid. Yeah. That's like something so I stupid. Wouldn't take, so I was out of there.
They returned home for their studies and focused on their passion, music. In 2010, their father sent a demo to a club in Merriam. There was a hole to open for the long-established ska punk band Fishbone, and for some reason, they got the gig.
We had no business playing that show.
We were not supposed to play that, but we did, and it gave us a really good head start. They didn't ask us if we had played a show before. Yeah. They didn't ask us how old we were. Mm-hmm. So we just got to get in, play our set. Everyone dug it. And then, you know, then you can say, hey, we opened up for Fishbone. So adult, like 21 plus clubs can say, hey, they're a real band. They have a half hour set. They can play this place. They open for a real band.
Slowly, Radke gained recognition regionally.
We get such great shows in KC and Lawrence.
Just like walking on the streets, we get noticed.
Yeah, know, it's
by people. It's
so
really,
fun.
It's a cool feeling.
In the last 3 years, they played at South by Southwest, the Afropunk Festival in New York, been written up in the New York Times, and toured to London.
They know our songs there. It's kind of nuts. Like, it's, I can't wait to go back.
Before we even get there, they know our songs.
Yeah, it was crazy. Like, we got, because some of our EP had been getting radio play, so, you know, at the Download Fest, people were up front and, like, mouthing words to the songs, and while you're playing, you're like, what?
Yeah,
and
you know, and you start a song, and cheers start, you know, going, it's like, wow, that's crazy.
Despite Despite their growing recognition over the past 3 years, as three black teens playing punk rock, Isaiah says they still have to overcome audience expectations.
I mean, I get a lot of people who are like, you know, how are you guys not like rap group? You know, like how did you do that? Like, how are you playing punk rock? It's like, okay, one, we listen to it. Two, we're doing it. And three, you know, just because we're black doesn't mean we have to rap.
Exactly. It's ridiculous. Like, some people have actually thought that we were a rap band just from looking at the cover of one of our earlier demos.
This place called Hammerjacks, we sent our picture and demo there, and they're like, oh, we don't book rap groups. And it's like,
oh, my goodness. Just
all right, we'll take our rap to another rock club.
And even though they're playing larger gigs, in St. Joseph, the crowds have still been hard to come by.
We play a headlining gig there on a Friday night, like 15 people maybe. Mm-hmm. Maybe I'm being generous.
That's generous.
Yeah. And it's like, you know, if we can't draw here in our hometown, like that just says something about the scene to me. It, like, that's what it is. Like, there's a lot of bands that play all the time to no one all the time. And it's just...
How do you guys, like, gear up for something like that?
Just do public practice, you know?
Yeah, you just pretend that there are a lot of people out there.
Yeah, pretend or just have a good time anyways, you know? I mean, we've played in front of, like, 11 people that are really enthusiastic, and that's fun, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, it's a good time. But if you're playing your hometown for, like, the seventh time after accomplishing so many things and no one cares, it's like, all right, well, I'm done then.
Other songs on their EP are inspired by their love of anime, the Japanese cartoons that often feature fantastical and sci-fi worlds disparate from ours. In so many ways, Radke goes against the grain of what you'd expect from a punk rock band. They aren't rebelling against political, social, or economic establishments, as their predecessors did. They don't even rail against their parents, as teenagers typically do. In fact, they spend almost every moment with them. And perhaps that's what's so refreshing about their sound, particularly in a genre that has fallen from mainstream attention. Despite singing illusions about cartoon worlds, they take their profession very seriously.
For live shows, we like to keep really high energy, like, but we don't like to fake it. Like, whatever you're feeling, like, do it. Be really sincere about it. Don't lie, you know. Put on a good show, because I feel like play good music, put on a good show, because why would you go see a live band if they're not going to, you know, put on a show for them, you know, hurt yourself, you know, do something.
And even with all their success, it's still important for them to play for their hometown. Saul, Isaiah, and Dee were all anxious to see what their upcoming show in St. Joseph would be like.
But the Rendezvous is a cool club, and hopefully the show is very well packed, because it's about time in our hometown. All the controversy, all of the hate, all of the love to get a good crowd.
That Friday in St. Joseph at the Rendezvous, the room was filled and many others milled about the bar. One audience member, Don Ashley, says he discovered the band just a year ago.
If you've never heard of Radke before, you should probably get off your ass and start doing something with your life, like listening to good music. I have a feeling they're going to be the next big thing right now. And not only rock and roll music, but punk rock music too, which is, you haven't seen a lot of good, like, honest bands come out of it. So,
as they gear up for a European and West Coast tour, they say they're not afraid to burn out. They've already developed a taste for touring.
We just loved it. Like, a lot of bands don't make it through the first week, and that's how you can see, like, if they're going to be able to be a band or not. But, like, we really dug it. Like,
I wanted to keep going. I didn't want to go home.
Yeah, I just want to keep on doing it. You know, just play a show every day, meet people, get better. You know, you feel yourself getting better. It's a good feeling.
It seems fitting that a band obsessed with watching anime and sci-fi would dream of a life on the road, a world very different from ours, where you can go from city to city like a wandering samurai, slaying the audience with song. For Casey Currents, I'm Matthew Law Middleton. This life of mine is full of only little things.
That's it for Casey Kearns today. Thanks for listening. Our live broadcast is every Thursday morning. If you missed part of the show, want to hear it again, or get in touch, check out our page at kcur.org or tweet us at Casey Kearns. Today's Casey Kearns was produced by myself, Alex Smith, and Suzanne Hogan. Our theme music is by Approach. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross, and see you in the new year.